Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. It's Peter Schiff. Welcome again to another live episode of Wall Street Unspun, midweek market update. This is September 30th. 2009, the last day of the month, last day of the quarter. You're listening live on my website at www.europac.net on shortwave radio, 5.07 megahertz, every Wednesday evening, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific. Well, it's been a huge quarter in the global equity markets. Not only were foreign stock markets very, very strong this quarter, I mean, I think even in the U.S., I think it was the best quarter in 10 years. But globally, we had even stronger markets. And, of course, the U.S. dollar was very weak in this quarter. The dollar index closed the quarter at 76 and change, I think 76.70 or so. Very close to the low of the quarter. I think the lowest we traded was just about 76 even. Other currencies were strong. The Australian dollar today hit a new 52-week high on the day, so it closed the quarter on the high of the year. The last time the Australian dollar was this high was actually in August of 2008. In fact, the Australian dollar is now at 88 cents, and it was at 60 cents. Back in March, which is about, two quarters ago, right? Or what is that, March? 6 months ago. That's almost a 50% move. You know, when the Aussie dollar hits 90, which I think it will do shortly, that's a 50% move in a six-month period. That is enormous. It's amazing that you can see a currency gain. I mean, to put that in perspective, and I know the Australian dollar dropped a lot, in the months leading up to that. So that's one of the reasons that it moves so dramatically. But, I mean, that is huge, on the order of relative purchasing power or standard of living. I mean, that basically means that relative to where it was 6 months ago, if, let's say, somebody from Australia happens to come to the United States, right, things are 50% cheaper. They cost half of what they, or something, here, whereas if an American travels to Australia, that a hotel room in Australia or, eating in a restaurant in Australia or going on a tourist attraction, the increase in the cost from 6 months ago is 50%. I mean, that's enormous. That also means that on a relative basis, remember someone living in Australia, earning wages in Australia, those wages are now 50% more valuable than they were 6 months ago relative to an American working for wages here. Now, what I think is going to happen, though, in the years ahead is I think currencies like the Australian dollar are going to continue to gain. But it's not simply that they're going to gain back, what they lost. I think they're going to make brand new gains to make new highs. I would not be surprised to see record highs across the board in currencies, if not by the end of 2009, by 2010. In fact, I think the currency that's got the best chart to me right now is the Japanese yen, which, closed the quarter out extremely strong. The dollar is now worth fewer than 90 yen. I think it's just under 89 yen. The lowest the dollar ever got against the Japanese yen was in 2005, where the dollar dropped down to 80 yen. And You know, the Bank of Japan came in and really intervened and heavily intervened. And, of course, they ended up dropping interest rates down to zero to make sure that the yen did not gain against the dollar. And, of course, that ushered in the famous yen carry trade, which, as I mentioned recently, is now over. The yen carry trade is dead. Unfortunately, long live the dollar carry trade, or let's hope it doesn't live very long. But unfortunately, it's probably going to live for quite some time to the detriment of America, but obviously to the benefit of people who are positioned in that strategy, or, you know, people who are investing in other currencies and commodities and foreign markets. They will all benefit as investors from this dollar carry trade, but as American citizens, they will not, because it's very detrimental to the U.S. economy. Certainly the Japanese economy did not thrive as a result of the yen carry trade. If anything, that kept the Japanese economy from performing, you know, much better. I think now that that trade is being unwound, that will be a positive for Japan, but it's a big negative for the U.S. Now, of course, the big difference between the underlying structural economies in Japan and the United States means that as investors around the world pursue the dollar carry trade, it will inflict much more damage, much more pain on our economy, because we're ill-equipped to withstand it, unlike the Japanese economy that was structurally sounder in that they had a lot of domestic savings. They had a lot of net exports, their net creditor nation, and so they were able to, you know, muddle through despite the fact that so much wealth was being siphoned out of the country in pursuit of that strategy. That is all going to reverse now. But the Japanese yen looks very strong. I would not be surprised to see the Japanese yen back at that 80 level and maybe take out new highs again, maybe as soon as before the end of this year, within the next 3 months, but certainly by 2010. And I think if we are getting an across-the-board sell-off in currencies, and it is interesting, again, and I pointed this out some time ago, that the yen is now correlated with the other currencies again. You know, during the big stock market sell-off in late 2008 and early 2009, whenever there was strength in the yen, there was weakness in the Australian dollar, or the New Zealand dollar, or the Canadian dollar. Today, you know, and I've already pointed out this pattern recently, you have a big move up in the Japanese yen, you know, about 0.75% higher today. But at the same time, you have a 1.5% move up in the Australian dollar and a 1.25% move up, or 1.5% probably, in the Canadian dollar. Strength across the board. The euro was strong too. So the dollar is dropping against every currency. It's not just that, you know, it's rising against the yen and then falling against the commodity currencies. The currencies are all acting as a block, meaning it's not just this unwinding of carry trades or moving, you know, out of risk or whatever they were doing. It's really a movement out of U.S. dollars into any other currency, or any currency but the dollar, and they're all going up as one. The only thing is the dollar's decline so far, even though it's declined very dramatically in the last 6 months, you know, there haven't been that many spectacular down days. I think I remember one or two days, you know, where the dollar index was down 100 points, you know, 1 point, meaning like over 1% probably in one day. It's just been a slow and steady grind, where the dollar goes down a few days and up a little bit, then back down a few days. And it's kind of like, you know, slowly boiling that frog. You know, no one seems to really appreciate what's going on here, or the magnitude of it. And, you know, I think that the markets are going to continue to move higher until the weak dollar really becomes problematic, because that's when the Fed, despite its rhetoric, is really going to be put in a box where it has to do something. So I think until the Fed actually does anything, you know, I don't expect any real significant declines in the stock market. You know, the Dow was down over 100 points intraday this morning, about 120, 130, ended up positive. It didn't close positive, but then it rallied back. You know, people are buying these dips. And I think, as I've been saying, the way this, you know, these losses are going to be borne unfortunately, is in the dollar, not in assets. You know, the Fed has picked its poison, and the poison it picked is inflation, and it is going to create inflation, and therefore it's destroying the value of the dollar. It's kind of ironic. It's that you've got a group of people out there who are bearish on the U.S. economy. They understand some of the fundamentals, and they understand that there's real problems. And so they don't want to buy stocks, right? Because I think the economy isn't really growing. It's all a phony. It's phony stimulus. And therefore, they don't want to invest, but they want to keep their money in cash or in bonds. I think these investors are going to get creamed. You know, they're going to end up, you know, being wrong for the right reasons. On the other hand, you've got another group of people who are just complete bulls. They're buying into the whole stimulus. They think the economy is recovering. They think the worst is over. Everything is great. These people are buying stocks. They're going to end up being right for the wrong reasons. And it's kind of ironic is the people who have got most of the story right and who are smart enough to understand that there are real structural problems for the economy, they're going to lose more money than the people who are blindly optimistic and are just piling into the stock market. Because this, I still think stocks are going higher, at least in nominal terms. Now, of course, in real terms, I don't think the U.S. stock market is going to outpace inflation, at least the real rate of inflation. It might beat the CPI, but, I mean, that CPI is meaningless with respect to the real rate of inflation. A far better metric is going to be the price of gold or maybe even other currencies. And I don't think U.S. stocks will beat gold. I don't think they're going to end up beating just a mere bank account in most other currencies, even though there will be certain periods of time where they will outperform. But I do think that the structural problems in our economy are significant, and as I've said many times, they are getting much, much worse, right? You know, we got some economic data that came out today. The ISM number was out. They were expecting it to get back above 50. Instead, it sank back down to 46. That shows an economy really in contraction. The jobs, we got the ADP jobs numbers, which come out a few days before the big jobs report that we're getting on Friday. And I think that showed about another $200,000 decline in non-farm payrolls. Now, the media, I think, was trying to spin this positive by saying that, well, this is the smallest decline in a year. Well, but it's still 200,000. The fact that we've been shedding jobs for a year and they're still dropping at a 200,000 a month clip, I mean, that's pretty weak. I mean, that's kind of hardly good news. You know, certainly, you know, there's more spending in the economy right now thanks to massive amounts of government debt. But why is that good? I mean, sure, a few more Americans are buying houses, but we're not creating any wealth. Just because one American sold a house to another American, all we did is transfer a title. But the problem is, in the process, we probably took the property from strong hands to even weaker hands, because a lot of these people buying these properties are doing it because of a government tax credit, which means, you know, we increase the national debt to transfer property from one American to another. And a lot of these guys are using FHA mortgages where they're only putting 3.5% down. Obviously, they don't, you know, they can't afford a house if that's the only down payment they have. And of course, they have no incentive to make the mortgage payment when they lose their job or the price goes down. And of course, a lot of these mortgages are getting the beneficiary of government guarantees and subsidized rates. So none of this is helping the economy. Of course, all the extra consumption in the economy is a net negative. We know we are much, much more into debt. If you look at maybe this quarter, the GDP is going to be positive, right? And everybody in Wall Street is going to be, hey, great, we bought a quarter of positive GDP. But what is the cost of that quarter? If it's trillions of dollars of extra debt, you know, is it really worth it? You know, are we really better off? No, our balance sheet is worse off. We impoverished our country further. We impaired our economy. And, of course, we socialized so much more of it. But, you know, what's going to happen is, of course, when this stimulus wears off and we finish spending this money and we find ourselves in an even deeper hole, now what's the government going to do? How much are we going to have to borrow next time to try to get some GDP growth? Because every time we use stimulus, we're going to require more and more stimulus for a smaller and smaller result. But each time we do it, we leave our economy further and further impaired. as a result of the stimulus because of all the additional debt. And imagine, of course, we had, I think one of the Fed officials was out yesterday or the other day, one of the member banks, saying that the Fed is going to have to tighten sooner than people think before it's obvious that the unemployment or this economy has turned around. And I think he said that we need to tighten as fast as we loosen. He's like that we need to, the Fed needs to drain the liquidity from the system as quickly as it flooded the liquidity into the system. This is what this guy was saying. Well, that's obviously impossible. There's no way to do that. Do you think the Fed is going to take interest rates from 0% back up to 5 or 6% as quickly as it slashed them from 6% to 0? I mean, that isn't even, that isn't even in the realm of some possibility. And if we were to do that, imagine the situation we'd be in. Imagine if the Fed, in order to drain that liquidity, had to dump $1 trillion worth of toxic asset-backed paper back into the market. Imagine if the Fed had to dump U.S. Treasuries into the market. What would happen? What would happen to the banking sector? What would happen to interest rates? Is this guy really serious? Does he actually think the Fed's going to do this? Now, they're saying it because they're trying to bluff. They're trying to get people to think, yes, this is going to happen, so they don't dump the dollar, so they don't dump, you know. But if anybody bothers to even contemplate the idiocy of such a statement, that our central bankers, our politicians, would actually do that. Of course, if they really were planning to withdraw the liquidity as fast as they supplied it, they wouldn't even be supplying it in the first place. Because remember, we're more, you know, hopped up, drugged up on credit than we were before, right? We have so much more debt now than we did a year ago, which means if the Fed has to administer the medicine of high interest rates now, it's going to be much more painful than had they, you know, never cut them in the first place, right? The medicine is going to go down a lot harder. So how is the Fed, how are these guys going to be willing, right, to administer the pain and suffer the short-term political consequences and the sharp decline in the economy a year from now, 6 months from now, when they wouldn't do it, when they're not willing to do it right now, or they wouldn't do it 6 months ago, when it's going to be significantly harder, significantly more painful a year from now? Remember, the more debt we have, the more painful it is when interest rates rise, because we have to pay the higher interest rate on a larger loan balance. I mean, it's not rocket science. So, you know, the Fed doesn't want to raise interest rates right, you know, now because the economy can't afford it. Well, it's not going to be able to afford it even less 6 months from now, a year from now. The longer they wait to raise rates, the less we can afford it, the worse it is. So it's all posturing. They're just saying what they need to say. They're trying to rattle the sabers. They're trying to talk tough. Yeah, we're going to withdraw this liquidity. We're going to withdraw this liquidity. There is no way. It's just, you know, ultimately they're going to have to do it. I mean, that's the reality, right? They're going to have to do it. That's how bad this is going to be. Because at some point, the government's going to have to say, you know, we've postponed it so long. If we don't do it now, it's Armageddon. I mean, all hell's going to break loose because the dollar is going to have no value whatsoever, and it's going to be pandemonium. And so then they're going to have to do it. And, of course, the recession is going to be really bad. Hopefully, by the time they do that, I will be in the U.S. Senate. I mean, I know, you know, I mean, maybe it's a long shot, maybe it's not. But, you know, somebody needs to be there because this is going to be pretty bad. And if nobody in the Senate has a clue, right, if they all think that, you know, that there's a stimulus is going to save us, that if we just go deeper into debt and buy more stuff, that we can borrow our way out of this crisis. If that attitude doesn't change and change fast, and you know, I don't know that the Congress is going to do this on their own. Just come to this epiphany. Somebody's going to have to be there, bashing it into their heads, and also to get them to understand not to push that pendulum back in the other direction. That, you know, it's not because of, you know, Michael Moore's movie is out there, you know, capitalism, a love story, that it's not capitalism that destroyed the economy. It's corporatism, it's fascism, it's statism, socialism, whatever you want to call it. It's this toxic mix of government and Wall Street acting together to undermine a capitalism and the free market economy, if we don't get our representatives to grasp this and grasp it fast and do what they can to undo the damage, right, at least to undo the legislative damage and the damage into the market of the moral hazards and the subsidies, we can't undo the actual economic damage that has already been done. Unfortunately, we're in this gigantic hole, and you know, we're here. Right, so we're going to have to play the cards that we were dealt, but we can't get out of this hole until we undo the damage to the market by the legislation and by the subsidies and by the tax code. Now, if we can do that, if we can, you know, get rid of that damage, then the free market will be able to function, and millions of Americans working individually, pursuing their own self-interests, will be able to, you know, work our way out of this hole. But, of course, it's not going to be easy, and it's going to take a lot of time because a lot of damage has been done. And we're going to have to, you know, atone for those sins before we can progress. Anyway, let me go to the phones. First caller. If you want to support my efforts for the Schiff campaign, Schiff for Senate, go to my website at schifforsenate.com. Donate some cash. Volunteer your time. You know, we are setting to get up the campaign right now. I've got a lot of traveling this month. Still, I'm in Chicago speaking at a Hispanic organization. I'm out in Hawaii for almost a week. I'm speaking at a conference there, and I got a client only seminar coming up in Chicago too. If you haven't signed up for that, I'm not sure if it filled up. We had a lot of people at the client seminar in Philadelphia a week or so ago, but the next one is coming up in Chicago. I was thinking about doing one in Hawaii, but I just really didn't fit it in. But once I get back, I mean, we're building out the campaign now. We're hiring the key people. We're working on an online campaign to incorporate the volunteers for both fundraising and getting out the vote and reaching out to Connecticut. I think it's going to be huge and very, very effective, and hopefully we'll really be, you know, fully launching this campaign out by the end of October so that, you know, we're full onto it by the month of November. But in advance, definitely sign up to be a part of it. It doesn't matter where you live in this country. If you've got a telephone and a computer, you're going to be able to make a meaningful contribution without spending a dime if you just volunteer. So you can volunteer, talk to your friends, anyone who's concerned about restoring liberty and retaking this government, to try to volunteer to work for the Schiff for Senate campaign, and definitely make the contributions, donate to the campaign. The more money we build up now, the more we can afford to do down the line. So we need your donations and support at schifforsenate.com. Anyway, first caller up is Ben in Grand Fark, North Dakota.
Hello?
Hey, Ben, you're on the air. All right, go ahead.
Oh, I was wondering, I had a question here involving economic theory. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that. I really haven't heard you talk about it. I was wondering if you could compare the pros and cons between the different types of backed currencies, like a silver standard that we saw in much of the world until the 19th century, a gold standard, which replaced the silver standard in much of the world, and then the bimetal standard that we saw in the United States during the 19th century.
Well, I think you're asking a question that's probably going to require a lot of time to discuss, as far as, you know, the pros and cons of bimetallic standard, which the United States was on through the Constitution, and whether you're simply going to have gold as money or silver as money. But, I mean, suffice it to say that either of those is preferable to having paper as money. You know, I mean, there's always a struggle to decide what commodity is going to function as the medium of exchange. What commodity will we make money? But the problem is, when you try to make paper money, you're saying, let's make something money that has no value in and of itself. You know, everybody always, when it, you know, the whole idea behind money is, you know, to replace barter. But the commodity that is serving the function of money has to intrinsically possess some value. That's the whole idea. You know, whether it's the Indians using wampum, or whether it was the GIs in the Second World War in Europe using cigarettes, the underlying unit that is serving as money still has itself some intrinsic value. So it still would be used in exchange anyway. The problem is, when you try to just say, let's just make a piece of paper money. That's the problem. Now, in theory, you can make that system work, but in practice, you can't, because the politicians that are always put in charge of limiting the supply of that paper because it has no real intrinsic value, they can never be trusted, and they always make too much of it, and the scarcity is gone, and it gets destroyed. But, you know, today, I don't think we even have to have those problems. I think the main reason that, you know, you try to have gold and silver both functioning as money generally has to do with the denominations and the coins and the ability to really transact in small denominations, because gold concentrates so much wealth in a small period, in a small piece, that if you wanted to buy, for example, if you want to go to the supermarket and buy a loaf of bread, well, you know, you can't, you pay for a loaf of bread using gold because you'd have to buy too much even in a tiny little coin. But I think what's going to make a lot of sense in the modern era, where we can, most, even if we were back on a gold standard, most of us wouldn't be walking around with gold coins to pay for things. We would have gold on deposit in our bank and use debit cards or something to access it. So I think we can easily just adopt a single metal, and we could use gold as, you know, and that would be fine. But anyway, thanks for the call. Next up is Dan in Illinois.
Hi, Peter. Big fan. I've been investing in gold and silver a lot recently, and I have a two-part question for you. We saw gold and silver actually decline in October, November of 2008 with the stock market, and it did shoot back up relatively soon after that. But could you expand on what happened and why gold and silver didn't actually go up at that time, and if that had anything to do with people's natural initial reaction of in a recession and putting more trust in the dollar, and even though the Federal Reserve was had all these inflationary actions? And also, do you think that gold and silver has now separated fully from the stock market, where if there's a huge decline, it would still go up because of inflation?
Yeah, well, I think the reason that we saw gold and stocks sell off simultaneously is during that period of time, everything went down. Every asset, whether it was commodities, whether it was precious metals, whether it was stocks, everything was sold, and a lot of it had to do with the fact that there were a lot of highly leveraged players around the world that needed to raise cash to either pay off debts, you know, meet margin calls, fund redemptions, as their shareholders, their investors needed their money back because they had problems someplace else. So everybody needed liquidity in the form of paper because, you know, that's what they needed. So people had to sell things in order to raise cash. And so they, if funds owned gold, they sold gold. And of course, then I think a lot of speculators also saw that everything was selling off, and so they shorted a lot of this stuff, which added even more selling pressure. So I think everything across the board went down. And yes, the appeal of the dollar obviously undercut gold. So many people misinterpreted the events of 2008 as being dollar bullish, and so therefore, the dollar assumed the safe haven role that should have belonged to gold. And so that was, you know, that's what happened. As far as has that totally been shaken? We don't know. I mean, we'll have to wait and see if we get a huge drop down. I do know that I did note in my newsletter, the last time we had a 200-point drop in the Dow in one day, about a month ago, gold finished positive that day. And so that was a good sign to me that maybe gold had decoupled, but we'll have to see. I mean, if we get a bigger drop, a 300, 500-point drop, if we get one of those, you know, if we see gold up, you know, substantially as opposed to down substantially, that would probably, you know, confirm it for sure. But yeah. I have a feeling that that's probably the case. I think more and more people are starting to understand what's going on. It's not panic mode anymore. It's not sell everything. I mean, I remember, back then, I mean, you know, all the things that I own personally, right, everything that I was long, gold stocks, oil stocks, foreign stocks, they were all getting killed last year, just like, you know, banks and home builders. And I'm like, you know, well, why? Why are my gold stocks going down as much as these home builders? Because people couldn't differentiate. It was like, just sell everything. Now, obviously, once the panic was over and the dust settled, you know, the gold stocks came almost all the way back. I mean, gold came all the way back. I mean, gold went down to 700, but look where it is. It's right back at around 1,000. I mean, the Dow didn't gain everything back. The Dow would have to be at 14,000 to have recovered everything. It's like 700. Gold recovered 100% of what it lost. Gold stocks have recovered probably 80%, 90% of what they lost, whereas the stock market has maybe recovered half of what it lost. I mean, so it's not even close.
Yeah, definitely.
And, of course, some stocks didn't recover anything because, you know, they went out of business. I mean, there are a number of companies that went bankrupt, and there's a number of companies that are still close to that. And, of course, a lot more companies would have gone bankrupt had the government allowed the markets to function. Instead, the government bailed everybody out. And as I said, that is what the government is doing. The government is making it clear that the losses are going to be in the value of the dollar, not in the quantity of dollars, meaning people are going to suffer losses of purchasing power, not nominal losses. And I think that's going to be especially true for creditors. The government is basically telling people, if you've got your money in a bank and it fails, don't worry, you're going to get your money. If you've got your money in a money market fund and it blows up, you're going to get your money. If you buy bonds of a highly leveraged investment bank and it fails, don't worry, you're going to get your money. The government is guaranteeing that everybody who lends money, everybody who makes deposits is going to be made whole, which means no one's going to be made whole because they're going to destroy the value of the money. The money is going to lose a lot of value. You know, look at the FDIC. That they just announced that they were out of money. They need to raise $45 billion. Now, they're making a big deal of the fact that they're not getting it from the taxpayers, they're getting it from the banks. Well, where'd the banks get the money? They got it from the government in the bailout, so it's a roundabout way. But this is just the tip of the iceberg. They're going to need a lot more than $45 billion. They're going to need hundreds of billions, if not over a trillion, by the time it's all said and done. And all that money is going to come from Ben Bernanke's printing press. And, you know, and again, that's what's going to happen. People have to understand that the losses are going to be distributed through a loss of purchasing power in the dollar. They're still going to be there. They're just not going to be obvious in a nominal sense, but they're going to be huge in a real sense. And so people have to understand that that's how it's going to be, that the trillions of dollars of budget deficits and the financial losses are going to take its toll, not on how many dollars you have, but what your dollars will buy, which is why people have to understand this dynamic and not, you know, be fooled into the temptation to try to hold dollars as a safe haven because you're worried about risks. The risk is to the dollar, and so people need to own the assets that people perceive as being risky. Like every time the media, Wall Street, tries to talk about, they say, well, the markets are going up because people are looking for risk, and the dollar is going down because people want risk. No. It's not because they want risk. It's because they understand that the dollar is where the risk is, and they want to get rid of that risk. So they want to get rid of dollars and own other things. Anyway, thanks for the call.
Yep. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks. Okay, let me go to David in Washington.
Yeah.
Hey, David.
The question I have is on the inflation-deflation situation. Now, I'm going to take the deflation argument, although I believe that inflation has to occur because it's the only way that they're going to be able to handle the debt, like you said. But currently, the large increase in base money that the Fed implemented has not been pyramided by the commercial banks, the member banks. And so as far as hyperinflation, the Fed is paying interest on the vast increase in reserves, trying to inhibit, apparently, the banks from pyramiding that money out, whether they're probably not able to because of their solvent situation. But until that occurs, how do you see any type of hyperinflation coming about? It would seem to me that the banks would have to be healthy enough to, and the Fed would have to allow them to start lending reserves down.
Well, the Fed isn't saying they can't loan them. They're just not loaning them.
Well, they're paying interest on it, though. So they're inhibiting, they're trying to keep them from loaning.
Well, right. Well, but the thing is, the banks are making a decision that earning interest on their deposits from the Fed is better than lending the money out and earning interest in the private sector and taking whatever the risk is of making those loans. But at some point, those dynamics will change unless the Federal Reserve just keeps increasing the rate of interest that it's willing to pay the bankers. At some point, the bankers are going to decide to put that money out. Now, I don't think they're going to put it out in the form of, you know, more consumer-based lending, because I don't think they'll do that. I think they might do it in other strategies, you know, such as, you know, in a foreign investing, or, you know, lending to hedge funds or speculators, you know, who are going to pay a much higher rate of return for those funds. But yeah, look, if the dollar starts to lose value fast enough, that's what's going to happen. But hyperinflation is not around the corner. We're going to have high inflation before we have the opportunity for it to turn into hyperinflation. Hyperinflation is the worst case scenario. But higher inflation is going to happen, because remember, even if the banks have this money, a lot of these banks should have failed. I mean, money supply should be contracting dramatically based on all these bad loans. The fact that the government is keeping everything propped up. But think about, you know, there's all this money already out there, already in circulation. There are billions and trillions of dollars being hoarded all around the world in U.S. dollars. That money is going to come into the marketplace, regardless of what the banks are doing with these reserves. You've got all this money that I think is going to come out of, you know, these other countries, and the dollar is going to fall in value. And, you know, as the dollar goes down, prices have to go up. I mean, because prices are a function of the value of the dollar. I mean, that's basically what a price is. It's the inverse of the value of the dollar. So as the dollar's value diminishes, prices have to go up. Let's say the dollar's value is cut in half, which I think it could be. It could happen in the next year or two. There is no way that prices are going to stay where they are. I mean, they should basically double to reflect that half of having a value.
So you think it would be more brought about by the foreign governments basically dumping the dollar? In other words,
foreign governments either selling dollars or not buying as many.
Dollar. Yeah. Traditionally the Fed tries to control inflation through the member banks primarily, right?
It doesn't control it at all. It creates inflation, and what they do is they create inflation, and then when the effects of the inflation start to push consumer prices up by a level that's unacceptable, then they try to pull it back a little bit, rein it back in, until they can start reinflating again. But you know, at this point, the consequences of easing back on that monetary throttle are so disastrous short term that they're not wanting to do it. So they're continuing to inflate, you know, and all they're doing is looking at, you know, maybe consumer prices, but prices should have fallen. Go back to the Great Depression, right? In the first few years of the Great Depression, consumer prices dropped by about 30%. I mean, that was what happened to the CPI. We didn't get that at all. We got maybe a 1% drop at best, but this is the biggest recession since that collapse, yet prices didn't drop. The reason that prices didn't drop was because of all the inflation we created. Now, government might try to say that's a good thing. That's a bad thing. One of the best things about the recession, the depression, was that prices went down. That's what eases the pain. I mean, prices were too high. They had to come down. We're not getting that beneficial result this time around because the government's not letting prices come down. They're printing all this money, and they're stealing the benefit and spending it into the economy. But at some point, government inflation is not simply going to act as a buffer to price declines. It's going to act as an impetus to big price increases. But, of course, it's going to be way too late to do anything about it by the time that happens.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't think at this point they could possibly let it deflate like that occurred in the 30s, because if you have a money supply contract like that, the debt, you know, we're much more debt-ridden now than
we've ever
been.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, so, I mean,
the U.S. government can't survive deflation. it can only survive inflation. At least that's what it thinks. But, you know, and the government thinks that the deflation is the problem that needs to be fought off. It's not. The inflation was the problem. The deflation is what corrects it. But the government doesn't want the correction. And, you know, that's what the guys who are, I think, stuck on the deflationary side, they look back into prior periods of history when we were on a gold standard, and they say, well, we're going to have this deflationary bust. Say, well, we would if we were still on a gold standard, but we're not. And the thing is, the deflationary bust is better than the inflationary bust. But, of course, when you have fiat money, when there is no limit to how much money the politicians will print, and believe me, no one is going to stop them. I mean, they will drop million-dollar bills from helicopters if it comes to that. That's what I think will happen. You know, they're just going to say, we need to get spending. That is their mindset. Their mindset is, we need people to spend money. They don't even care if what we buy, as long as we're spending. So in the final analysis, the American spends, you know, $1,000, but instead of getting a television set, he gets a pack of gum. But the government is happy because he's spending. They just want spending going on.
Yeah, see, that's why I don't understand why they're trying to, I mean, it seems like they're trying to inhibit the banks from lending with paying interest on those reserves. That's the only, I mean, Bernanke is, I mean, those guys are obviously, they don't want too high of inflation.
Well, I don't know. I think, A, they're trying to keep the banks in business, so they're giving them money for nothing, right? They're paying them interest.
Yeah.
I mean, the government is giving them that money in the bailouts, right? The government gave them that money, and now they're giving them interest on that money. I mean, the whole thing is insanity. But
yeah, it's just another bailout is all it is.
Keeping these banks in business with taxpayer money. And the reality is, of course, the banks don't want to make the loans. Who are they going to loan the money to? They're going to loan it to Americans to buy more stuff on their credit cards? Why? They can't pay back the money. Do they want to make more car loans or they want to make more auto? No. Now, it would be good if they can loan it out to American entrepreneurs to start businesses. But you know what? That ain't going to happen until we radically reform our tax code, until we deregulate, until we have a more competitive wage structure, unfortunately. So there's not a lot of viable places for these banks to lend this money out anyway right now.
Yeah,
now,
well,
at some point,
when you become a senator, that's what you're going to have to push. You know,
At some point, though, I think when the dollar really starts to crack and the dollar carry trade really gets into higher gear, the banks are going to look at all this money and say, hey, we don't need that little bit of interest that we're getting from the Federal Reserve. We can take this money that the Federal Reserve gave us and we can buy foreign currencies with it. We can buy gold. We can buy almost anything and be better off than what we're getting. And I think that's going to happen. Unless they really raise interest rates, and I see no indication that they're willing to do that. Anyway, thanks a lot for the
call,
Dave.
Thanks a lot. Mm-hmm.
Next caller is Terry up in Canada. Go ahead, Terry.
Yeah, hi, Peter. I just wanted to ask, is the information you're suggesting about going to gold, is that for Americans only, or is it for Canadians, they should just let your dollar fall and buy it later, or? That was my first
question.
Look,
I think everybody should buy gold, including the Canadians. Look, the Chinese are buying gold, right? I mean, everybody should own gold because gold is money, and everything else is just a money substitute, and you never know. So people should have gold. It doesn't mean that they have all their money in gold, but people should own some gold, and, you know, wherever you happen to live. And, you know, so Canada, no exception.
Okay, well, my other question is unrelated. I was following Diane's letter there, and he had me all on uraniums, and he foresaw the real estate crash. He foresaw everything that was coming, and the place to hide was a little bit in precious metals and then uranium because it was the, you know, energy solution and yada, yada, yada. Well, they went down 90%, and they've barely come back at all, so I basically got wiped out. All the way down, he was saying, bye, 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 the next rally is coming. And it never came, and it still hasn't come. So I'm wondering, for you, with your advice, do you have a black swan event that could just totally blow you out of the water with all your suggestions? Like, is there something that, you know, you haven't, that could just totally go against everything you're saying? That you have you looked at the worst scenario to your theory?
Well, I mean, the worst case scenario for my theory of investing, you know, is that, you know, we get more of what happened in 2008, where, you know, every assets go down and the dollar goes up. Now, you know, what would produce that outcome? At this point, I think the only thing that would produce that outcome is a substantial and aggressive increase in interest rates by the Fed that was far more aggressive than any of the other foreign central banks, so that interest rates in the U.S. rose sharply relative to rates around the world. Now, I have a hard time believing that that's what's going to happen. And even if that does happen, this is the problem. If the Federal Reserve aggressively increases interest rates, then we get even more bank failures, even more a bigger real estate bust. And now what are they going to do? Are they going to let all the institutions fail that they just bailed out? Because if they bail them out, then they have to abandon the rate hikes. See, that's the thing. It's like the government, in order for the government to pursue a strategy that I think is detrimental to the way I'm investing, they're going to have to do all the things right that they did wrong in the past, but now it's going to be even more costly politically. And then, of course, even if they do all the right things, if they let all the banks fail, right, if they let the brokerage firms fail, if they let real estate collapse, if they let all this bad stuff happen, is that really good for the dollar? Is it really good? I mean, it's hard to believe that even that collapse is going to be good for the dollar. It's not going to be as bad for the dollar as printing all the money to bail everybody out, but certainly that collapse, that massive U.S. recession, is not going to be dollar-friendly. Now, it was dollar-friendly in 2008 because of the massive unwinding and deleveraging, but I don't know that that has to happen again. I mean, I think a lot of people are out of those trades. You know, I think they've unwound the yen carry trade, or, you know, if they haven't unwound at all, they're in the process of finishing it up. So, you know, I don't know. But, you know, most of my clients who, you know, went through the decline in 2008, you know, they didn't get margin calls. We weren't leveraged. Many of those clients who were down are now ahead. Many of them are still behind. It depends on whether or not they added to their account or, you know, where they got in. But they're down a lot less than they were. And, you know, so there's, you know, they didn't get – so the event, that black swan type event, you know, it knocked us down, but it didn't knock us out.
Well,
and
sure
I still think –
they're knocking the uranium sector out. For those of us that are not...
Well, yeah, but you can't... Yeah, uranium stocks, though, were always highly speculative stocks. And we had some uranium stocks, but they were speculative stocks. You can't say, I'm going to only own uranium stocks as a defensive play. I mean, that makes no sense at all. You can own uranium stocks, you know, as a more of an aggressive, especially after they'd gone up so much. I mean, if you'd have bought them, you know, 7-8 years ago when nobody wanted them before, you know, but even then you wouldn't put all your money into it. But I still think the biggest risk, the biggest potential black swan out there, is the collapse of the dollar. And that is the event that I think, A, is the most probable, and B, the most damaging to savers and investors, which is why that is the primary threat that I want to guard against. And I think that's paramount. And in order to protect myself against that threat, I think it's worth the risk that in the short run, we have some kind of rally in the dollar that undermines the short-term performance of the foreign assets that we own instead of dollars.
Okay, and so those of us outside the U.S., should we wait till your dollar starts crashing and then sort of start buying up gold coins and all that kind of stuff? If it sounds
no, because gold coins will be going up. I mean, from a Canadian perspective, what you would do when the U.S. dollar crashes is that's a time where you as a Canadian would be able to come down and not buy gold, because gold would have gone up, but you can come down and buy a condo in Miami, or you can come down and buy a yacht from an American who's you know, got to sell his. I mean, you know, or, you know, it'll be time to come down and bargain shop down in the United States, but gold will not be a bargain because gold is a global commodity and gold's price will rise.
Well,
anyway,
thanks. Down and get warm. I got my fireplace on for the first time this year, so it'd be nice to come down there and warm up a bit.
And plus, you Canadians are nice people. I guess it won't bother too many Floridians to have a lot of Canadians down there. There certainly are a lot of empty condos now down in that part of the world. Plus, there's a lot of them out in Las Vegas if anybody wants to go there. Anyway, the next caller is Leon in Texas.
Hi, Peter. You hear me?
Hi, and let's not take any new calls. I think I have two more in the queue. I'll try to get to everybody in the next 10 minutes. Go ahead.
Okay, so my question is about the Fed. Fed obviously is going to have to deal with high interest rates in the future if they want to pay off that debt. But my question is related to SDRs and issuance coming out of the G20.
Well, I don't know. I've heard the talk about the special drawing rights, which would be a currency issued by the World Bank that potentially would act as an alternative to the U.S. dollar as a reserve. And as I said before, my position is that it does not make sense to try to create a new reserve currency. The only reason that the dollar is functioning as the reserve currency now is because it was backed by and redeemable in gold. Because prior to the dollar being the reserve currency, there was no reserve currency. Yes, the British pound was a currency that was in use a lot internationally, but it wasn't the reserve currency. Reserves were kept in gold. America convinced the world to exchange gold for dollars and to use the dollar as a reserve because the dollar was as good as gold because it was redeemable and backed by gold. So now that that's no longer the case, the world doesn't need to find some other fiat alternative for a system that never should have existed in the first place. And I think they will figure that out, and they don't need to try to recreate another reserve currency. If they're going to go to another reserve currency, I think they're more likely to use existing currencies than some concoction out of the World Bank, which would either be the euro or the Japanese yen, or maybe there would not be any one reserve currency, which I think is more likely. I just think it's more likely that central banks will hold as their reserves much higher percentages of currencies that are not the dollar, such as the euro or the Japanese yen. And I also believe that there will be a significant increase in the percentage of reserves held in gold bullion. And right now foreign central banks have the lowest amount of gold bullion on reserve in history. And so there's a lot of buying to do.
Well, the SDR is a basket of the weighted euro, yen, and I believe sterling and US dollar. So
yeah, but it's a yes. Right, but then there's an extra currency issued against that basket by the World Bank. Why introduce that extra layer? Why have the World Bank, just if central banks can create that basket on their own without having to funnel it all through the World Bank, which I think is a mistake. Anyway, thanks for your call. Next up is Robert in Minnesota.
Hey, Peter.
Hey.
Hey, I just had a quick comment about your campaign. I think so often there's it just seems like people in the middle of the road kind of get turned off by capitalism, free markets, and it always seems like, I love hearing about it, and I could listen to you talk about it all day, but during your campaign, I think it would be really helpful if, I don't know if there's a list of like five great examples or examples where specifically how we can show the middle about how, basically government's got in the way and how crystal clear these examples are. I think we could persuade a lot more people.
That's what I do. That's what I do now is I use analogies and I show people how the government screwed things up. And I remind people that America became a very rich country and we didn't get so rich by accident. There was something that we were doing right that other countries were doing wrong or that our other currencies weren't doing as well. And the reality was we prospered more because we were freer. We were freer in the sense that the government let the market work, the market allocate our resources, and the government allowed the successful to be rewarded and the people who were not successful, lost money or just didn't reap as many rewards. And so people had incentives to go out into the world and work as hard as they could to achieve as much as they could. And so, we were we had a lot of ingenuity. We had a lot of invention. There was a lot of stuff accomplished, and we became very rich. And the problem is now, we have government being added, in all areas of our lives, so that we no longer have that comparative advantage that we had in freedom over the rest of the world. And obviously the rest of the world has caught up and in many places surpassed our standard of living. And so if we want to go be back on the right track, we have to dismantle all of the big government programs and policies and subsidies and expenditures that have been layered onto this economy, over the years, by the populists or the socialists or the politicians trying to get votes and trying to buy votes with these promises. Anyway, I'm running out of time. Thanks for your call. Last caller is Charles in Washington, D.C. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thank you, Peter. I just have a quick question. You know, in the 1980s, the gold went up to 800-something and then crashed later. I'm just wondering why that happened again. Should we hold gold forever? When do you sell it?
Well, remember, we had a spectacular rise. Gold went from $35 an ounce up to $850. I mean, your gold stocks went up 100-fold. But, of course, remember that in order to break that bull market, it required Ronald Reagan and Paul Volcker, right? And we've got the exact opposite of that right now in Ben Bernanke and President Obama. So I don't see a Reagan-Volcker combination anywhere on the horizon. And, of course, it would take much more Herculean efforts this time to correct the imbalances because they're much worse. So I don't think we're going to be selling gold anytime soon. But believe me, if I see the conditions where I think it's safe to go back into dollars and U.S. stocks, believe me, I'm going to be screaming as loud as I can because we're going to have a lot of foreign profits, I hope, to repatriate when it really is safe to get back in water over here. But right now, it's shark infested. I wouldn't come anywhere near it. I would hold on to my gold. Anyway, that's it. Thanks for the call. I know we're running out of time. Look, I thank everybody for tuning in. First of all, remember, we're talking about investment strategies on the show. Of course, there's risks in everything, everything that you do. Strategies can lose money. There's no guarantees that foreign stocks will do well, that gold will do well, that dollars will do well. So you've got to consider all the various scenarios and all the various risks. And, if you really want to pursue some of these strategies, I mean, my suggestion is that you call Euro Pacific Capital. Call us up at 800-727-7922. Talk to a broker. He can go over with you in much more detail the strategies, the risk rewards. You can determine, what is suitable, what's not suitable for your particular situation. And, now I've got the mutual fund. We've got the China fund where, even small investors can come in if they're aggressive and they can get some diversified exposure to the China market. So make sure to check out the China fund if you're looking for that kind of exposure. Anyway, thanks again. And remember, Perth Mint, I talked about buying gold at the Perth Mint. The coin business that I'm trying to get off the ground has not started yet. It's still in the works. Hopefully sometime in the month of October we can launch that. Anyway, thanks again, everybody, for tuning in. Remember, come back again next week, Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific. Thanks, everybody. Remember, shiftforsenate.com, shiftforsenate.com, and europac.net. And don't forget, Crashproof 2.0 in the bookstores on Amazon. If you haven't got 2.0, pick it up. It's definitely worth it. Even if you got the first one, it's got 80 new pages, 25% more than the original version. So pick up a new copy. You can use the other one as a gift. Remember, Christmas is coming up in a couple of months. Take care, everybody. So long.